You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. This week, my guest is Edmund White, and I'm taking advantage of his presence in the studio, which was occasioned by the publication of his new biography of Jean Genet, to talk to him about the evolution of his own work and style and present and future. And I'm glad to have you with us.
Thank you.
You know, Forgetting Elena was a monumental event in my life because it was a book that went from a kind of Kafka-Beckett beginning that, you know, if I don't turn to the left, I must turn to the right. If I don't turn to the right, I must turn around. If I turn around, to something ecstatic and primitive and ceremonial. How do you describe the movement of that novel?
It's certainly odd, isn't it?
It's terrifically odd.
Well, one thing that had impressed me is I have a very good girlfriend who is a painter. And I remember she once said to me, isn't it funny that people just assume that if something is abstract and cerebral, it should be gray? There's actually no logical reason why it couldn't be gorgeous. And that was a remark that sort of stuck in my mind. For instance, she said, why did the early cubists think that they had to paint in grays and browns and neutral colors? They could have painted in flamingo pink if they wanted to. And I think what you've really put your finger on exactly what I wanted to do, which was to take the sort of chic, bleak Beckett novel and inject ceremony and color into it.
You know, as you say this, I've never thought of this before, but perhaps it was because the movies were in black and white, and in terms of new forms, movies were so influential on prose. And what's more, I think about that phrase, they weren't in color because for the longest time in Technicolor, they didn't know how to control the hue. Maybe those writers, Beckett, etc., so austere, felt that the variety of color could not be controlled in prose.
It could be. You might be right. But even the painters tended to use very neutral colors. Or if you think of Giacometti, he used bare plaster or bronze. But, I mean, mind you, these are all artists I admire enormously. Another thing that I think accounts for some of the quality of Forgetting Elena is that I was very influenced by reading the pillow book of Sei Shonagon. And she's this Japanese court lady of the 11th century who, in a way, entirely replaced ethics with aesthetics so that she makes lists of favorite things.
Sexy preachers, which is my favorite of her lists.
Right, sexy preachers. Or one of her odious things is eating strawberries in the dark. or she's very unhappy with the idea of beautiful snow on the house of poor people. No, she's a terrible snob and very funny, and I think the ultimate dandy. So I was very interested in the whole question of dandyism. I think one time it occurred to me that Susan Sontag had written so brilliantly about camp because she was really of two minds about it, that there's a kind of rabbinical side to her that despises gay boys sitting around and laughing about 1930s films. And on the other hand, there's a dandified side of her that despises people who pull a long face when they have to talk about art. So she really was exactly on the crest between these two tendencies, and that's why she was so perceptive about the whole phenomenon. And I thought, in the same way, if looking around for a subject that, in fact, was one I felt two ways about, and both ways very powerfully, was the whole question of ethics and aesthetics, or the whole question of sincerity and authenticity, if you will. And that was something that tormented me in my late 20s, when I was writing Forgetting Elena.
With Nocturnes for the King of Naples and Caracole, you seem to have, if not discovered, certainly come under the sway of Ronald Fairbank. I sometimes think Fairbank of the baneful influence because it's so hard to either escape from him or to outdo him. Of course, there are other things as well, but had Fairbank a decisive imprint on you during those years?
I'm not sure, because I think that, yes, I mean, I read him constantly. I even wrote a little essay about him. I admired him enormously, but I think I never tried to emulate his humor, which is the most important thing about him and which is the most elusive thing. And I had an ambition to create genuine overarching forms for my novels, which I don't think he had. I mean, after all, he was somebody who wrote words on slips of paper and accumulated all those slips and then would stitch them all together and finally make a novel. It's like he's stringing pearls on a thread. And there's always this epigrammatic, humorous quality. But I do think that Forgetting Elena actually is the one that I see as more Furbankian in the sense that there's a moment where the woman who turns out to be Elena is reading from her memoirs to everyone, and people make very sort of campy and strange and totally unexpected remarks about her work, and there's this sort of excruciated artistic sensibility at work at all times. I mean, everything has been turned not just from first degree to second degree, but from second degree to fourth degree, so that we hardly know what to think about their remarks, and everything is so loaded, everything is so removed from any original human impulse that it is sort of a torture, a kind of exquisite torture, to read what they're saying about everything. So to me, that's the real Furbankian book, whereas I felt that Nocturnes for the King of Naples was a bit influenced by Genet, but very influenced by a lot of mystical literature, St. John of the Cross, the Sufi poets, even John Donne. I mean, there was a lot of poetry. And buried into that book, there's a sestina, there are couplets, there are sonnets. And I think of all the readers, only James Merrill is the only one who's ever spotted them.
It's funny. I guess I'm thinking of nocturnes in the terms that, say, Gauguin used to describe the paintings of Moreau. He said his people are jewels wearing jewels.
Well, I mean, it's funny. There are people who, I remember once Calvino's wife, Chichita, said to me, "Oh, I don't like this book. It's very sentimental, and you're not a sentimental person." So if there are people who think it's all too much, or as you might think, there are other people, especially gay men, who have read the book as though it were this terribly moving personal testimony. And
well, I'm not against jewels wearing jewels. I mean, that's not an objection.
As Henry James said, I can stand a great deal of gold.
It just is what aligned the book to Furbank for me.
I see what you mean, yeah. Well, certainly it's you know, didn't somebody once write a book called The Well-Wrought Urn? I think mine's The Overwrought Urn.
Well, I found myself thinking perhaps that the books, if they do form any kind of arc overall, Forgetting Elena to Nocturnes to Caracol to A Boy's Own Story to The Beautiful Room, it was toward an apparent simplicity and then decomposition of structure. Now, I'm always wrong about these things, so you'll pardon me in advance, but I remember thinking when I read the first chapter that what seemed to be up was the shaping of a story, sort of like a Guy de Maupassant story, that would be full of a kind of narrative, meticulous, scrupulous perfection that would undo itself, too, that would call its artifice into question by somehow falling at the last minute out of the strictures of its anticipated structure. Is this at all familiar or dreamable?
Well, I mean, the truth is that writing terrifies me. I don't really think about things too much when I'm doing them, and I'm very thrilled if I manage to finish a chapter. Then sometimes I'll wait 3 months, 6 months between chapters to get up my nerve to write again. I guess I sometimes, when I'm seeing myself in an attractive light, I think of all this hesitation as being like Rilke's, you know, I'm sort of waiting for lightning to strike you again to write another elegy. And until and through Boys on Story, I was an alcoholic. I stopped drinking after that. But an alcoholic can be very eloquent chapter by chapter, but can't really think of overarching forms too much. I mean, that sort of contradicts what I said earlier, because the truth is I was interested always in those forms, unlike, I think, Furbank, and I was always trying to get them together. But I would sort of hold my breath and think, can I get through a chapter? And I think you feel a lot of disjunction from chapter to chapter in Boy's Own Story. You've been flattering enough to suggest that there was some overall design, but I'm suggesting that just the exigencies of trying to survive and write against these impossible odds of being an alcoholic were pretty much the reality underlying the composition of that book. Whereas after that, I stopped drinking and I had a clear head. So I think that Caracal, for better or for worse, lives less on its nerves and is a more composed book, which is precisely what some people don't like about it. But it's a very different kind of book.
And The Beautiful Room is Empty.
Well, The Beautiful Room is Empty, I think, has a different kind of technique. I wanted to write a page-turner. All my life, I always wanted to write a book that would make you want to read on, because I was tired of people saying to me, oh, I love your writing. I read one page and then close the book and savor it, you know. And I wanted to write something that where people would sort of forget about my writing and would be drawn in by the story. And I had my designs on the reader that were not just the local pleasure of the text, but a kind of overall fictional structure of suspense and mystery and so on. So it, I think, is calculated to make people read on. And a lot of people who aren't particularly literary like that book the most. And I think it's partly because it draws you in and is easier to read and slightly more transparent than my other books. However, people who are rather literary oftentimes will say to me, the funniest thing about that book is the way you will slap down one sentence next to another without any real proper transition. And there's a kind of little spark or shock that is required in getting from one sentence to the next, and a lot of implied irony.
Well, the title always seemed to me to be a kind of joke title, you know, that if the people who did not like the earlier novels would be inclined to join Beautiful and Empty. And do you know what I mean? And,
yeah.
And it seemed to be, I don't know, this...
It actually comes from a letter by Kafka to his girlfriend, Milena.
Right. I know that. I just thought, no, to be honest, I had read that in an interview with you. It wasn't something that I knew as a matter of course. But at the same time, it does become the title of the book, and I found myself watching the contrast between Beautiful and Empty, you know, the oppositions forming across its surfaces.
Well, I mean, the Kafka quote is you know, where he's writing about the impossibility of intimacy, I think, and he says to her, I sometimes feel that we're two people standing on opposite sides of a room, each of us beside a door. And when you come into the room, I hide behind my door. And when I come in, you hide behind your door. And sometimes we're both hiding behind our doors at the same time, and the beautiful room is empty. And I think what's remarkable about that sentence, I mean, is the word beautiful. Because most people would regard the emptiness that exists between two people when they fail to communicate as ugly or regrettable, certainly not beautiful. And I love this sort of odd displacement of that word, which made me feel that we can find beauty, not just ironically, but actually, in states of being that psychologists or decent people would regard as lamentable.
That's funny. In your biography of Genet, I'm speaking to Edmund White, the author most recently of a monumental biography of Genet. In the section describing, the very funny section describing Genet's friendship with Violette Leduc, there's a description of Genet's superb shoes, and the superb there seems to tilt both ways, you know, toward irony and toward accuracy, one supposes.
Well, that's right, I hope.
The first book, Forgetting Elena, has that cloistered feel of the openly closeted book, the book that you look past the prose. But unlike earlier novels in the century, it's an appropriation of that elusive and exotic style. It's not very long for a reader to guess that this is Fire Island, or that one needn't be an initiate, and the novel's joke seems to be to treat all readers as if they were capable of seeing into its interstices. Did finding a sexual identity occur first in prose or in life?
For me?
Yes.
In life. I mean, I was active as a homosexual by age 12. But actually, I started writing very early on gay novels. I wrote a novel when I was 14 called The Tower Window. I went on to write lots of gay fiction, so much so that when I had a play done off-Broadway at age 22 with Cicely Tyson and Billy Dee Williams, my father, who was a very conservative businessman and former cowboy, said with some despair, "What's it about, the usual?"
I guess, you know, since the first book has an implied audience of readers who get it, in quotes, and the other books has an audience of people it knows are comfortable with the book, has this changed your stance as a prose writer?
Well, actually, I think in my early writing, my ideal reader was a European woman who wasn't gay and who knew English well but had lived only briefly in America. In other words, Mrs. Nabokov. And that was a sort of filter to make sure I wasn't just nudging the reader in the ribs and making little coy allusions of a kind of in-joke sort. I have to tell you a sort of biographical fact about myself that I think is interesting, is that the first artists I ever knew were abstract expressionist painters. And I would sit for hours with them, and it was a kind of monastic discipline, looking at their work. And when you're a kid, I was like 14, to learn to not ask, what is it about, but to appreciate the tension that underlies a painting and not seek for anything as an outside reference, affected me very deeply, and it really changed my whole vision, so much so that then later when I took a Rorschach test, I honestly didn't have any associations. I didn't feel the need to see things in these abstract patterns, which I think must have made people think I was psychotic. So one of the ambitions of Forgetting Elena was to write a book that would be almost purely abstract. And it was sold to Random House, but only on the condition that I would rewrite it, giving it a kind of mystery story plot, which I was, as a writer who had already been rejected by 21 publishers for that book, I couldn't dare say no. So I added a kind of structure to it, which may or may not make it better, but certainly changed it from its original intentions, which were much more kind of cloudy, abstract, non-referential, and had a lot more to do with the push and pull of the abstract expressionism of the 1950s. But if that was my rather exalted notion of art, I think that all of us are worn down by the culture we live in. After I published Caracol, for instance, Edward Roditi, who was a wonderful old poet in his 80s then, now dead, said to me, "Well, you've written a very great book, and if you write another one like that, you won't have a career." And it's true that maybe if you're a poet, where the publisher knows from the very beginning you're only going to sell 800 copies, and they have to have one or two of you, you have a certain kind of dispensation. But if you're a prose writer, they still expect you to turn a buck for them. If you want to go on in this culture, living and writing, you've got to sell a few copies, and you've got to be aware of reader response.
Now, you mentioned earlier that you felt in our time that the true avant-garde-ism is in subject, not style, and that homosexuality is an avant-garde subject.
I do think that. I mean, it seems strange to say when you enter a gay bookshop now and you see all these terrible, trashy books. But the truth is that if one could rid one's mind entirely of all politically correct attitudes, of AIDS, of coming out novels, and of even the distinction between homosexuality and heterosexuality, and settle in to this subject matter in a very phenomenological way, a way in which you inhabit a space that isn't labeled and doesn't have political definitions attached to it, then you really would be writing something kind of new and interesting. I'm not sure anyone could do this. Certainly Harold Brodkey tried a little bit. I don't think it worked, but he tried to do something like that. I think that Robert Gluck probably is the most successful in doing it. Your friend Dennis Cooper, who's also my friend, I think is extraordinary in the way that he has chosen one or two very narrow wavelengths to stay on and doesn't care what horrible label is attached to him. And in fact, he, like Bataille, like Genet, like Sade, is willing to really look into the abyss. These are some of the most interesting writers in America.
Tell me, is there yet in France, elsewhere, a Genet of AIDS? Is there a writer who worships as beautiful the progress of the disease? Has there
Hervé
been?
Hervé Guibert.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I just wrote an article for the London Review of Books that was 16 pages long, an analysis of most of the, of 12 of Hervé Guibert's work. And he's, of course, the guy most famous for his book, To the Friend Who Did Not Save My Life, which is somewhat about his friendship with Foucault. But as I try to show in my essay, when he started off, long before he had AIDS, he had a longing for death, a hatred of his own body, though he happened to be one of the most beautiful people who ever lived, and a fascination with everything kind of malsain, creepy, unhealthy. And he found his great subject matter in AIDS because it sort of brought together all of these things. And he's sort of half in love with easeful AIDS, you know, and he uses it in a very unusual and interesting way. I don't think so much in the books that are known in English as in the very last book he wrote, which is called Paradise, in which the virus had actually entered his head, and he had toxoplasmosis as well. And he's severely disoriented while he's writing it. But he was a compulsive writer who literally turned his body into a fountain pen. So he was still writing this stuff through all these extreme states of mental disorientation. And it's brilliant. I mean, he is a brilliant writer, I think, and a fascinating person to read.
Is that book translatable, or is it so wed to
no,
French?
No, it could be translated. Because
I hope
he doesn't.
It will be.
Yeah, it's called Paradise. Mm-hmm.
It's been published in Paris.
Yes, it was published in 93, the beginning of this year, the beginning of 93.
I was fascinated by For the Friend, you know, that Who Did Not Save My Life. That seems an extraordinary book, and it seemed to me, too, that of course it would come first.
He's a very interesting writer because he's a writer who could never have flourished in our culture because he's somebody who doesn't make a big deal out of each book. Each book is like a chapter in an ongoing books. So sometimes he'd bring out two or three books a year, and they would cost 40 francs, and they'd be published in little kind of easily accessible editions published by Édition de Minuit, later by Gallimard. And they had all the sort of excitement of confetti. Whereas in our English-speaking world, a book is a big deal. There's a lot of promotion. It costs a lot of money. People review it, and it has to mark an important step in the development of each writer and so on. So it sort of precludes this kind of spontaneous writing that some writers very much need. And I think Hervé Guibert was very well suited to his own culture.
I'm curious, since I do have the tendency of looking at everything as an aesthetic statement or as potentially meaningful aesthetically, is the collaboration with Adam Morris Jones a statement of any kind? You know, authorship having been at one time so singular, and post-AIDS, perhaps collectivity becomes more important.
Well, yes. I mean, I think you're quite right. I mean, I think that we published the Darker Proof, which is a collection of his stories and mine, all of which are about AIDS or being HIV. We published that in paperback original, first in England, and it was very important to us that Faber promised that they would bring the book out about 2 months after we finished our work on it. So, you know, usually a book comes out in hardcover, costs a lot of money, it's very overly reviewed, and it's expensive. And this was the contrary of that. It was closer to this kind of Hervé Guibert book that I've been talking about. And that spontaneous aspect of it and the abnegation of this being my book or his was also, I think, important to us. One of the things we felt was that AIDS fiction in general was composed of novels which have their own built-in trajectory, which inevitably ends in death. So there's something kind of pious-making and I think slightly off-turning, certainly very serious and noble, about most AIDS fiction. And we wanted to avoid that by writing short stories, which we thought would allow us to get into and out of this terribly cliched material that seems to dictate its own form at an odd angle. You see what I mean? I mean, I mean, in other words, we didn't want to show the deathbed scene with everybody weeping, the Benetton ad, or the end of Larry Kramer's The Normal Heart. We didn't want to have that scene, and we didn't want to show the onslaught of the disease and the list of all the medications and all the medical failures. Mind you, as a human being, I'm not making fun of this. My lover has AIDS. I'm positive. I'm up to my eyeballs and all this stuff, and my whole generation's been wiped out. But talking about it artistically, I mean, I think the definition of sentimentality is unearned emotion. And by that definition, an awful lot of AIDS literature is sentimental because the subject is not created from the ground up. It's not rendered. It's simply cited. And we assume there's already a whole tradition of this kind of writing.
But one of the effects as well, it seems to me, of Genet is that there is no horror that is not so immediately subsumable to the avant-garde that it becomes a cliché of the avant-garde.
There are a lot of ideas that I call the permanent avant-garde. I mean, there are ideas that have been around so long. I mean, like ideas invented by Pirandello, for instance, which are still treated as though they're interesting and new. I mean, I think, in fact, the whole notion that I've suggested today that there's a kind of avant-gardism of content is an idea that one hasn't really heard very much, and it really disturbs people to hear it.
Well, I think it is interesting because it seemed to me that this whole Baudrillard idea of simulation is in fact really the Pirandello idea in industrial drag, that the invented or literary characters should be interspersed among actual ones, that this is a version of Disney's audio animatrons and that therefore the culture is a version that keeps manufacturing inauthentic versions of the self. Yes, it's a modernized six characters in search of an author.
Sure.
I've been talking to Edmund White, the author most recently of Genet, a biography recently published by Alfred Knopf. He's generously agreed to talk to me about his own fiction, and thank you very much for joining me. This is Michael Silverblatt. You've been listening to Bookworm. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Scott Fritz. Join us again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of ice and snow in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold in books.
Books, books, books.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.